Today on Talk is Cheap, it's Women's Day, and so this is a conference on Women's Day from 2002 in Los Angeles. You know, one of the women that doesn't get much recognition is Madeline Murray O'Hare. She almost single-handedly, stopped prayer in school and was murdered, she was harassed by Christians for doing that, but it was thought that she was murdered, but it turned out it was one of her assistants, apparently. So, my mother met her working for J.P. Tarcher as a bookkeeper when Madeline Murray O'Hare wrote a book, and mom said she cursed like a sailor. But yeah, Madeline Murray O'Hare, great woman. Happy Women's Day. Talk is cheap. KUPW 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, Low Power FM. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
I'm going to tell you about a woman, but first, Vote, It's a wonderful idea to have people have an experience. And we can get some of that by being a commission. We learn about policy and education and a variety of other things. I certainly have learned that as I'm the State Library Commissioner. And we have an opportunity on March 17th, of which we'll have some more of these in the back. Those of you who are interested or know some women who might be interested in coming to the workshop, we'd like to encourage you to come. Also, the United Nations has just put out its first newsletter of this year, and there are copies in the back. If you could take one of those, also there was something we created fresh this time, and I'm hearing so many good things about it, I think we're going to continue it. And that is, it's got a section in the center that says, if you only have 5 minutes to do something, what would you do? And we have a few choices, things you can do that are advocacy, that will encourage, support, and increase the awareness of the various important issues that we talk about. It goes on down to what would you do with 20 minutes if you had 20 minutes free time, and all the way down to a couple of the events in there that might take 4 or 5 hours. So we certainly thank you for all your good comments about the newsletter. If you know anybody else who wants to be in it, certainly you can call us, email us, all the numbers are there. Thanks very much, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and thank you for your collaboration so that we can put on another wonderful program. Thank you.
Onward youth to
the struggle for a happy, socialist, Polish village. This poster was produced while Joseph Stalin was still alive, and the terror of his dictatorship was still felt throughout the Soviet Empire. In Poland, the communists tried to sell the philosophy born in Russia of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Women, the Soviets said, would hold a special place in that kind of a society. They were to be equal to men, enjoy the same rights, the same privileges, the same responsibilities. Unlike the bourgeois societies of the West, Russia and its satellites did not want to keep their women at home. They wanted them in the factories and out in the fields, where they could enjoy the pleasure, equal to men's, of building an idealist socialist state. The poster with this young woman on the tractor was part of the communist propaganda campaign in Poland to sell their notion of a free and equal society for women as well. That was in 1951. Now, if you would, let's turn to another image. It's the mid-1980s. The Solidarity Trade Union, which dared to challenge the communist authority in Poland, has been outlawed. The movement's leaders are either in prison or underground. In the spring of 1985, I leave the city of Łódź on foot. Łódź is Poland's textile center, and it is midnight. I'm in the company of women textile workers who are on a pilgrimage to a site where they will see Pope John Paul say Mass the next morning. We arrive at a field which is really an airplane landing strip at about 4 a.m. There is time to drink tea and eat sandwiches we have brought with us, and even to nap before the pontiff actually arrives via helicopter. I see excitement and cheering and tears everywhere as John Paul lands and then climbs into a vehicle with a bulletproof bubble that carries him through the crowd into the altar. But then I look behind me just in time to see this picture. A man has climbed on the shoulders of two women, so he may get a better view of the Pope. The women did not protest. I know they are textile workers from the varicose veins protruding from their swollen legs. This is a common consequence of labor in the weaving rooms. I'd like to go forward a bit now to March 1998. When I was in my work office in Warsaw, at the Warsaw Journalism Center, and a friend of mine at the BBC in London had set up a telephone interview with me for a women's radio program. I was supposed to talk about International Women's Day and a country that for decades was part of the Soviet bloc. The women who worked in my office with me then were all Polish, and they listened carefully to my conversation with the BBC. They could not believe their ears. For decades, they had tuned into the BBC daily on their shortwave radios, even though doing so was illegal. The London Channel was one of their few sources of real information, and so they listened, even though it was interesting. The BBC was for them as sacred as the Bible. When they heard the words, "This is London," they believed they had the truth. And now, the BBC was calling to inquire about International Women's Day, which the women on my staff viewed as a creation of communist propaganda. International Women's Day, like all the accoutrements of Soviet socialism, did not take root in Polish society. It was considered an absurd custom and a cruel propaganda routine that reminded women of the harshness of their lives. It is true that Polish women, while they were still young, climbed into the driver's seat of tractors, but they did not smile. They did not derive a sense of accomplishment from their work in the fields or in the factories. Really, they felt hardly nothing, for they were numb from the exhaustion they had felt since they were 13 or maybe 14, when they had presented falsified identification papers at one of the numerous state-run employment offices. They had to work in order to keep their families together. The story of the women of Eastern Europe, and especially in Poland, is the story of women in times of change and what women do in those times of change. Poland has been the object of foreign rulers' lust since about the 12th century. The country repeatedly has been divided and its borders have shifted. It has even disappeared from the map. This historical condition shaped the lives of the Polish people. It affected their vision of the world and fed their desire for independence, and it also spurred their quest for a national identity. Happily, in the last century, the notion of democracy took precedence over nationalist thinking in the minds of the leaders who brought Poland out of the Cold War era. The place of Poland and women in Poland's last period of change, from the end of World War II to the establishment of a democratic government in 1989, was similar to the position of women in the Third World. Although they lived in the middle of Europe, their lives were determined by conditions of poverty, chronic shortages, and a feeling that they had no control whatsoever upon the world around them. These problems plagued Polish women of all classes, intellectuals, workers, and peasants. Although they spent hours each day waiting in line for meat or shoes or even toilet paper, the women in Poland also found time to make a significant contribution to their country's last peaceful revolution. In fact, I would risk positing that without the women, Poland's revolution might not have succeeded. However, I think it is important to understand that women did not come to the movement between U.S. Solidarity, the trade union movement, with their own agenda. In fact, when I first met female trade unionists from Poland in 1983, they were baffled and even offended by my intentions to study the women in Solidarity. They told me I was trying to force a Western feminist perspective upon Poland, and I was warned that would not work. Women, I was told, face difficulties no different than men. It is only in the past 10 years, since the formation of the first Solidarity government, that women in Poland have started to organize around issues which they recognize as crucial to them because they are women. I think that from a historical perspective, we can understand why feminist priorities were articulated later. It's the same story we hear in many countries at many times. Solidarity was striving for broad social change. And the trade union wasn't just a trade union. It was a political movement that threatened and challenged Poland's socialist system. Its goal was to overthrow Poland's communist government and establish a democracy. So the stakes in Solidarity's struggle were extremely high. And in order to win, the movement had to be focused and ignited. For this reason, I think, and I'm not saying I agree with it, but I think that for this reason, women put their needs on the back burner. Most likely, they believed, just like everyone else in Poland, that if Solidarity were to come out on top, they automatically would get what they felt they needed. As I said, it's not my intent to judge or criticize the women of Poland. I don't believe I'm in a position to do that. All I would like to do today is to tell you what I've learned about their lives. And I would like to share with you some of what I witnessed of what they paid for the changes that they made in their society. I went to Poland for the first time in 1983 as a journalist during the last days of martial law. And in 1984, I took a residence in the country. Except for 1 year I spent in the States during my father's illness and death, I lived there continuously until 1999. The first long-term project I did was in the city of Łódź, the textile center. I went there to study the women in Solidarity. Because it was the textile center and the workforce was largely female, I figured I would find many female union activists there. Because I needed an official cover, at that point not just anyone was allowed into the country, I applied to study through the sociology department at the University of Łódź. This was on a Kosciuszko Foundation grant. And as a result, I had contact for through my underground network, probably one of the most important women I found was a woman by the name of Maria Filipovic, who had been the vice president of the Solidarity chapter at the Marfevsky Mill, which was the largest textile plant in Bruges. Two asides here. She was the vice president. The president was a man. Another aside, when a friend of mine who was a correspondent for the New York Times went to Bruges to try to talk with the women in the leadership at the local level of Solidarity, he was told there was no woman in the local leadership of Solidarity. Solidarity also was not especially kind to women. But Maria was there, and she did her job. She was a lively, energetic, blonde woman who was very smart and who spoke her mind and who was very concrete. You would not get around Maria if you had a problem in the plant. She would demand a change. Her life was typical of the lives of many Polish women, especially those who were working class. Her husband was an alcoholic, and she divorced him. She was raising her daughter alone. Her union role involved organizing and running the chapter of the Solidarity Union in her plant. She worked herself in the weaving room. She was arrested when martial law was declared, and she was blacklisted. That meant that she could not get a job in the state-run economy. That's where most of the jobs were in Poland under the communists. Instead, she finally got a job sewing at a private small garment manufacturer, and when I met her, she was earning about the equivalent of $10 per month. At that point when I met her, she was not working in the plant, but she kept in touch with old friends, and they contacted her when they wanted to talk about the problems. She introduced me to them. We would meet at a flat. We would arrange the meeting with no phone calls, because they could not talk about me over the phones. They were tapped. When we got together, they would talk about their jobs and their families. One thing they told me about was the way International Women's Day was marked in their plant. On that day, women who had joined the Communist Party received gifts. They received things that were hard to find in the stores, like stockings, shampoo, soap. Those who were not Communist Party members received nothing. This was a way of convincing the women that they should join the Communist Party. The method often did prove successful because women's lives were so difficult then that they might grab at any offer of relief without taking into account the consequences. The women I met through Maria, Marisha as I knew her, were almost without exception married and had several children. They belonged to families where the husband and wife usually worked both in the textile factories. That meant that they had to work opposite shifts. One worked the night shift, one worked the day shift, and so they rarely saw each other. When a woman finished her work at the mill, she began her housekeeping duties, shopping, which took hours because you had to wait in line, laundry, cleaning, care for the children. The husband, as often as not, was an alcoholic. He did not contribute to the home in any way, often not even the money he earned at the plant. There was one other problem with the arrangement in the family, and that was because they worked on opposite shifts. There would generally be a time when either parent was at home, leaving the children alone, no matter what age they were. And one of the most moving stories I heard from the women was about a friend of theirs from the plant who found herself in this situation where there was a block of time where the child, who was still quite young, about two, was left alone. Unfortunately, during an absence one night, he crawled onto the window ledge and fell to his death. That was one of the consequences of the working life that they had. You also have to understand the way people took care of the business of running a home in Poland back then. As I mentioned, there were constant lines in shortages. Once, when I went to a meat store, although I don't like meat and generally wouldn't do that, I didn't have to buy it for anybody. I didn't have that obligation. But I went to a store in the summertime, and I got 2 days later, it turned green in my refrigerator. I did that once. These women did that day in, day out. There's another story that Pradeen was kind of telling. A friend of mine, this was an intellectual circle, a wife of a journalist. I used to spend some time at their homes over the weekend or things like that. And one day I was helping her with laundry. We were folding her sheets. And the way you did laundry like that was if you were lucky enough, you had a washing machine to wash the sheets at home. You had to do them by hand, and then you generally hung them to dry in your bathroom or on the attic floor of your apartment building was sometimes open. And then you had to fold them, and you took them, they were made of a very rough cotton. They had to be, before you could use them, it was just very uncomfortable to sleep on them. They generally had to be pressed, ironed. And we were folding these sheets one day, and she said to me, "So, do you do your own pressing of your sheets back in the United States?" And I looked at her and I said, "Well, no." And she said, "Well, what does it look like?" And I told her about permapress sheets that come out of the dryer without a wrinkle in them. And she looked at me like I had told her the biggest lie that anyone from Persian West that I was forgetting, or that it was at least a fairy tale. In other words, some of the many things that we take for granted, for them meant hours and hours of extra work and made it very hard for the women. So that's what I learned about women's lives from my underground context before my official connections to the Communist Party at the plants went into gear. And finally, one day, I was invited to tour the Mark Leskey plant where my dear friend Marisha had worked. They told me to come to the propaganda department. They weren't embarrassed about it. Go to the propaganda department. That's where they'll meet you and show you around. There was a woman by the name of Anna Svolnechna. That means Sunny Anna. And she was a member of the Communist Party and the head of the propaganda department. She greeted me, and the first thing she did was to take me to a room which was called a Room of Memory. It was set up like a worker's residence during the time of the capitalists. It was a very drab room with a drab pair of shoes in front of the bed and a drab piece of carpet on the floor and a drab coat hanging on the wall. And in the room, there was also an album. This was an album that contained the history of the Mark Leskey plant. Sunny Anna opened the book for me, the album, and pointed to a photograph. And it was a photograph of a woman, and she said, This woman is one of the greatest enemies of the socialist state and one of the greatest enemies of this factory." It was my friend Marisha, who had created the Solidarity Movement in her factory. After Anna took me through this room of memory, she turned me over to her assistant, who was a young man, and he showed me the entire production process at the plant. We saw where the cotton was delivered, how it was cleaned, how it was spun into thread and then dyed, and the last stop was the weaving room. Now, weaving rooms must have high moisture level in order for the machines to work right. In this weaving room, there were old machines that often broke down. Andrzej Wajda had done a film called The Promised Land, which was about 19th century Poland in this factory in 1968. At that point, the only thing he had to change in order to make the factory look like real 19th century was to replace the light bulb fixtures. Nothing else had changed. The women were usually assigned about 20 to 24 looms that they had to set up and then wash for broken threads that they would run around 20 looms. And their earnings in part were determined by the quality of the fabric they turned up, whether or not there were holes from threads that were broken. Now, these were electric looms. The ceilings leaked. But the worst thing was the noise. And this was something I wasn't completely prepared for. I had heard that the noise level in the factories was about 120, 128 decibels, but I didn't know what that meant. When we got to the door of the weaving room, my guy from the propaganda department stopped me and said, "Now, when we get in here, it's going to be a little bit noisy, so that meeting room to the other door. And when we got up to the sun, he told me to sit down. And he looked at me and said, "And what else would you like to know about the way we were moving forward?" This was a member of the Communist Party and the assistant head of the propaganda department. The vibration that the women felt from this noise, the noise itself was partially a problem. It caused deafness naturally. But the vibration from that noise and from the machines running also upset their menstrual cycles and affected their nervous systems. In some cases, it was known to have driven women mad. Because of all of this, I think that it is amazing that in spite of all these difficulties, women, including working women, including those women of Wuj, found time to participate in the politics of their country actively in the underground. One of the major accomplishments of the opposition in Poland was the underground press. It was enormous, well-organized, and it reached everyone. It kept people informed. My contact to the underground press in Wuj was a woman by the name of Rzeczyna Wujniewska. She was the wife of the chair of Solidarity in all of Wuj. And when I would go to see her, she would pull out newsletters and magazines from all corners of her apartment. I'd have to get up off the chair because she had one under the cushion. I'd have to get one from behind the picture, or she would have something in the cupboard. Of course, she had to keep it hidden because if she were searched, it was illegal to have all of that stuff, and she and her husband could go to jail. But what was important was that I saw that these average working women from a class were taking this literature and reading it when they went home. They talked about it. You have to understand what literature looks like when it comes off the underground presses. It is small print. It is very hard to read. And just the fact of reading it would have been a major effort for these women in the state of fatigue that they would have been in when they came home. But they did it. The underground press was actually, in many ways, women's territory in Poland in general, not just in Wuj, certainly in Warsaw. They were very important to women. They worked as editors, as writers, as couriers, and they were actually better at making jobs and deliveries than the men were. This is because they were not as prone to bravado as men. This is what I was told to the people who ran the underground press. They were more reliable. They didn't take chances. The men would also all often take chances, and then they would lose whatever they were carrying to the police when they were caught. And they would also lead the police to the points where the literature was being produced. And as a result, they would use equipment. Much of it was computerized, and also the heavy presses and the supplies that they needed to carry on their work. Some women who came out of the underground press have emerged as leaders in the publishing industry and in journalism in the New Poland. Just one of these, for example, is a woman by the name of Helena Luchibo, who used to be the editor of the Solidarity Weekly in the Warsaw region, which had a circulation in the underground of 80,000. Today, she is the head of the first independent newspaper that was to be published in Poland since World War II. It is now the most successful media enterprise in the country, and it is largely due to her work and probably to a lot of the skills that she learned in the underground that she was able to make that newspaper happen. As Helena's life shows, women are changing Polish society today. They're making new places for themselves. They're presidents of corporations. They're high-ranking union leaders, not the leader, but they are high-ranking. They are members of parliament. And Poland has even had a female prime minister. But of course, even though there has been progress, women still face an uphill battle in Poland. It turns out that the democratic system does not automatically pay attention to women's issues, nor, of course, does capitalism. The women of Wuj know this is true. The last time I visited the city in 1999, I found the Markleski mill had been boarded up. Programs had been set up by the government and by NGOs to try to help women and textile workers transition to new jobs. But the safety net was full of holes, and many women peaceful revolution in Poland was successful, and women were a major part of that effort. That, you know, was true. One of the most famous journalists in Poland is a gentleman by the name of Ryszard Kapuściński. He's covered over 27 revolutions in his lifetime so far in the Soviet Union and Africa and Latin America, and he recently made this comment. If there is any lesson from all the failed revolutions of the 20th century, from communism, pan-African or pan-Arab socialism, it is that there is no shortcut to the future. The ideological path to utopia is cheating. It is unworkable, impractical. Consequently, history has arrived at its pragmatic moment. People try to do what works. They do what they can. The era of great leaps and futile dreams, he concludes, is over. I believe that Ryszard Kapuściński is probably mostly right. The answers to our world's serious problems do not lie in ideology. This holds for the issue of women's rights as well. But if that is my perspective, why have I been called here to speak on International Women's Day? What I would suggest is that we must reclaim this day and take it from the ideologists. We must use it as an occasion to bear witness to and to celebrate the accomplishments and struggles of the women we have known. With that in mind, I would like to close with something from the Russian poetess Irina Rakushinskaya, who at age 28 was sentenced to 7 years hard labor for writing poems that were deemed anti-Soviet propaganda. She put the dilemma that faces both men and women who struggle against tyranny and for a more just world in these words, in a poem called Our I Had a Dream. I had a dream, steeds and horse claws, a hand with a prickly ring on my shoulder, and the bitter face of a brown icon, and the solid murmur of a thousand swords. After that, I don't remember. The grasses grew tired of lamenting injuries, the wolves of howling, and someone sang over the corpses at the transit camp, and our wounds dried up, and we were thirsty. It was August. The stars grew bright and fell into the campfires of the soldiers, and it was still not too late to save the motherland. So it seemed to us. We waited for the hour, we rose, and in saving for the umpteenth time, we walked into the grass and ceased. A crazy girl ran barefoot among us with a cry, not to kill. It's so simple. Just when I think my motherland is going to absorb the guileless lesson, no. The waters rust, the women wail, and we shall rise up when the moment comes. Thank you.
Don't happen, that's right. Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism. Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism. Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism.
To you by Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Silt River Tree Museum and Casino, built on the site where an actual rainforest once stood. See a full-scale replica of a 500-year-old Douglas fir tree. See trees larger in diameter than a man is tall. See pictures of trout and salmon that once choked the rivers of the Northwest. Every Friday and Saturday night, see Feller Buncher and the Chainsaws, an all-ex-logger band in our simulated wood amphitheater. Take the Northwest Desert Highway to the clear-cut road exit until you come to the stump in the road. Turn right and you're at Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Kids a buck and a half. Free parking, closed during summer months due to global warming. Also brought to you by Billy Bob Clinton's Missiles R Us. Hi, I'm Billy Bob Clinton, the largest dealer of missiles in the world. I've sold more missiles than anybody. I'll eat a bug to sell you a missile. I got a herd of missiles. I'm practically giving them away. They're stacked up here like cordwood. No cash. We have instant credit. We'll take most any type of collateral. We take oil, minerals, cheap labor, just about anything. This week's special, F-15 fighters, only 5 left, so get here fast. Take the Pennsylvania Avenue past Silo 16 till you see the crater in the road. Turn right and you're at Billy Bob Clinton's Missiles R Us. Come near closing time wearing a thong and I'll show you a wrinkled missile. Also brought to you by Gluteus Maximus Excon Cranium. Do you still think women and people of color are inferior? Do you think George W. Bush doesn't know the lyrics to the Horse Vessel song? Do you think multinational corporations care about people and the environment? You may be suffering from terminal ignorance. Made from 100% Amanita mushrooms, Gluteus Maximus Excon Cranium has been shown to actually remove the brain plaque associated with terminal ignorance. Pick up some Gluteus Maximus Excon Cranium today before it's too late. Side effects are compassion, forgiveness, introspection, and hysterical laughter.